Campus FM presents a talk organized by the CERN entitled Free to Believe, a Religious Conscience in a Secular Society. This talk is delivered by Professor Roger Trigg.
Your Excellency, President of the Republic, Your Excellency, Reverend Gentlemen, Ladies and Gentlemen, good evening. If secularization is lying on its deathbed, with, as Grace Davy remarks, Europe being the exceptional case in this affair, the debate on the place of religion in the public sphere is still very alive and kicking. In recent years, religion has emerged as an increasingly important aspect of national and international politics, as an argumentative cultural force, and a subject of sustained public debate. Several social scientists are seeking to study religion, secularism, and related topics, and to expand critical scholarship in this crucial area. Habermas has moved towards a more positive position about the role of religion, though he still sees a limited role in certain spheres. He argues that informal political media, such as Parliament, the arguments used must be secular, because this is the only language all participants can share. Similar statements have appeared in the local press, though with no reference to Habermas himself. This is in contrast with the words which Robert Bolt attributes to Thomas More, when a statesman forsakes their private conscience for the sake of public duties, they lead their country by a short route to chaos. At a time when conscience is being literally bandied about left, right, and center, I have the honor to present Professor Roger Trigg, who will be lecturing to us tonight on the theme, Free to Believe, a Religious Conscience in a Secular Society. Professor Trigg is Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at the University of Warwick and a Senior Research Fellow at the Ian Ramsey Center at Oxford University. He is also the coordinator of a major interdisciplinary project in Oxford on cognitive science of religion. He is the academic director of a new center entitled Center for Religion in Public Life, which is also seated at Oxford and based at Kellogg College. In 2003, Professor Trigg became the first chair of the British Philosophical Association, which was founded to represent all British philosophy. He is the author of numerous publications, amongst them Rationality and Science, Rationality and Religion, Ideas of Human Nature, Understanding Social Sciences, and his latest publication is Religion in Public Life, Must Faith Be Privatized? Later this year, Oxford University Press will publish his book, Equality, Freedom, and Religion. Professor Trigg.
Your Excellency, ladies and gentlemen, well, thank you first for inviting me to Malta. Ever since I did a geography project at the age of 12 on Malta, I wanted to come here, but I'm afraid it's taken till now to actually get here. But it's good to be here and see Malta. Now, I'm a philosopher, and I've been used most of my life to be dealing with rather abstruse principles and not to open the daily newspaper and see reference to things I'm working on. But since I've been dealing with religion in public life and issues about religious freedom, barely a day passes in any country I'm in where I don't pick up a paper and read something that's relevant to what I'm writing or thinking about. The whole issue of religion is a hot topic. And, true to form, when I open the Times of Malta over the last few days, I find that the whole issue of religion in public life, of conscience, is coming to the fore in connection with the issue of divorce, of which I've no doubt you're all very well aware. Now, the question is, of course, whether, in fact, religion is dominating or whether something else is. Now, here in Malta, it's easy to look at the paper and think that actually religious people are calling the shots. But that isn't true in most of Europe. There's an aggressive secularism sweeping the continent, particularly Western Europe. Now, this isn't, I think, typical of the world. Secularization as a sociological thesis was put forward in the 1960s. It was suggesting that inevitably religion was on the wane, partly through the influence of science, that religion's influence would get less. We needn't think about religion except as the private interests of a few rather old-fashioned people. Now, of course, even the people who used to put forward that thesis, now much older and, I dare say, wiser, realized it's wrong. It's been proved conclusively, empirically wrong over the last few years. Religion is important nearly everywhere. You can't understand what's going on without understanding, in fact, that religion is influencing things. I dare say we can't really understand what's going on in the cataclysmic events in North Africa and the Middle East without seeing that religion is part of that mixture. Now, it's all too often easy for people to actually say that religion, as I said, is private, it's personal, it has no part in public life, no part in public reason. Well, I'll come back to that for a moment, but let me just stress this business about secularization. Because I've said it's been proved false. I've said it isn't true in most of the world. It isn't true in China, where Christianity is growing. It isn't true in Africa. It isn't true in Latin America. It isn't true in the United States. But it is, of course, still true in most of Western Europe. You'll find that in many countries, church-going has declined precipitously. The influence of various churches has declined. Secularism in various forms is dominant. And you can see this in the way that European institutions are working. The Council of Europe, for instance, in its Parliamentary Assembly, representing most European countries, it sees human rights as in opposition to religion, not as an outgrowth of religion. It's very much the old Enlightenment French Revolution view that human rights are going to free us through reason, from the authority of the church, from the deadening hand of tradition. And the Council of Europe says that the separation of church and state is one of Europe's shared values, transcending national differences. Now, actually, as a matter of fact, that's plain false. You can count the number of countries in Europe where the church and state are not separated on more than the fingers of one hand and more than the fingers of two hands. But that doesn't stop French secularists, Spanish socialists calling the shots here. The Council of Europe also says, nor may states allow the dissemination of religious principles which, if put into practice, would violate human rights. Again, there's this idea, you see, that religion is one thing and human rights are another. Religion is a threat. Religion is a source of division. Religion is a cause of conflict. And it goes on, if doubts exist in this respect, and this is something that it passed only 3-4 years ago, if doubts exist in this respect, states must require, note the word require, religious leaders to take an unambiguous stand in favor of the precedence of human rights, as set forth in the European Convention of Human Rights, over any religious principle. Just stop for a moment. I mean, it may be that perhaps they're just thinking of the nastier elements in Islam, radical Islam, Islamists. It may be that that's all they're thinking about. But as they state it, it sounds as if states must require bishops, the Pope, anyone, to take an unambiguous stand in favor of the precedence of human rights. Religious principles don't matter, human rights do. Now, as I go on to argue, I think that's a false dichotomy anyway. But here are parliamentarians setting themselves up against religion. I've always thought, actually, that one of the strengths of religion and Christianity in particular is that it sets up an alternative source of authority to the state. It suggests that the state is not the only authority. It's why totalitarian states usually see religion as a tremendous threat. And it's why, in the end, religion can undermine totalitarianism. But here, no religious principles are being pushed on one side. The state decides what's right. Equality, non-discrimination, become more important even than freedom of conscience, particularly religious freedom. And not only must religious viewpoints then not be given any privileged position, what worries me about what's going on in a lot of countries in Europe at the moment is that those viewpoints aren't even being respected. They're being viewed as a threat to the current fashionable emphasis on human rights. Now, perhaps just in parenthesis, I'd say, of course, there is another issue here. The European Convention of Human Rights was mentioned, and of course that is implemented by the European Court of Human Rights. There is, I think, an ongoing issue as to whether courts, particularly international courts like that, should be able to override democratically elected parliaments. I just throw that in as a question. It's a particular issue in the United Kingdom at the moment, where the European Convention of Human Rights has applied in Britain by the European Court, says that prisoners must, in fact, be allowed to have the vote. It's been a basic issue in British law that, in fact, the people who don't have the vote are lunatics, prisoners, and members of the House of Lords, probably all rated much the same. And I think that it's been pretty deeply ingrained in British democracy that if you break the law, you at least temporarily give up your civil rights. You don't make the law. And this is now being challenged by the European Court. And so it isn't who's right only, but who decides what is right? The Parliament or the European Court? And of course that is an issue that perhaps one day might affect Malta too. Anyway, what's happening in Europe is that the right to freedom of religion isn't being respected. And yet, if you look at any convention of human rights, any charter, freedom of religion is always given great priority. In the United States, it's often called the first freedom. Now, that's partly because it just appears first in the First Amendment, but I think there are good historical arguments to suggest that it was put there very deliberately because the founders, people like James Madison, one of the early presidents of the United States, who was instrumental in putting forward the Bill of Rights, he felt that freedom, democracy, depended on religious freedom. And that's always been built into the Constitution of the United States. But I think it says something important to everybody as well. Certainly political freedom and religious freedom have usually gone hand in hand. Anyway, the right to freedom of religion is a right. So at the very least, it's there in all charters to be considered. And yet all too often it's being trumped by other rights, rights, as I said, to equality or something like that. Diversity is being celebrated as an end in itself. How often do we find the words equality and diversity being mentioned in one breath? Now, diversity, if it's celebrated as an end in itself, of course, is leading us to relativism. Now, I've been writing against relativism for 40 years, and so I was particularly pleased to find that it's one of the things that Pope Benedict has been emphasizing tremendously, the great cancer of relativism, and particularly in Europe, which says and thinks it's tolerant in so saying that everybody's belief is right for them, is true for them, may not be true for other people. And live and let live. But of course in the end it's saying nothing is true, nothing matters, doesn't matter what you believe. You believe what you like, I believe what I like. Doesn't matter at all. And that's nihilism in the end. So I think it's a very, very dangerous position. Well, to go back to the issue of conscience, which I think is being challenged in so many European countries, let me just give you a few examples. Medical ethics is a good example. I expect you're all familiar with the issues that can arise with abortion, contraception, where medical practitioners might find that they're being pressured to take part in practices that they don't think are ethical. I think one that's coming up on the horizon that really illustrates this is that in some places there's a real drive, and in some American states, for instance, to legalize euthanasia. And you can imagine that very soon, if euthanasia is legal, there'll be pressure for doctors to offer that service, perhaps on the National Health Service in Britain. And how can a doctor who's entered the profession to save life deliberately end it? Isn't that itself an illustration of actually going against the very conscience that led the doctor into the profession? And yet I can imagine we could get to that situation because consciences aren't being respected all too often. And I've read this being put forward very seriously in medical ethics journals. If a doctor doesn't in fact find him or herself willing to do certain things that are expected in hospitals, they should leave the profession. Well, people with a conscience should get out of medicine. Now, that doesn't sound very promising for the rest of us. Now, a very contentious area at the moment is the issue of gay rights, civil partnerships, even gay marriage. It may not be an issue here yet. I have no doubt one day it will be. It's certainly an issue in the United Kingdom. It's certainly an issue in the United States. And obviously a very contentious issue. And obviously a lot of people have a very strong conscience against being dragged into anything that might suggest that they are complicit in that allowing that kind of thing. There's been quite a well-known instance of a series of lawsuits in Britain recently where a civil registrar lost her job for being unwilling to register civil partnerships, which in a sense some people would say is gay marriage in all but name, but it isn't marriage, but it is giving people legal recognition to same-sex relationships with ceremonies. The English Court of Appeals put the issues of human rights, non-discrimination against homosexuals, and equality above any idea of freedom of religion. So not only did the civil registrar lose her job, but the English Court of Appeal said it was quite right that she did. They even went on to assert that beliefs about marriage aren't a core part of the registrar's religion. I found that very worrying when they said that, because I don't think it's up to a court to decide what is or is not a core part of a religion. Is a belief about marriage not a core part of Christianity? I would have thought it was. Certainly, Christian denominations are splitting over the issue of gay marriage and gay rights. The New Testament is full of comparisons of, for instance, the relationship of Christ and the church with husband and wife. Marriage is held extremely seriously. It would seem to be a very important part of Christian belief. Yet the English Court of Appeal knows better. They can rule what is and isn't important. And I think that illustrates a very dangerous tendency of courts, that some seem quite willing to get involved in theological arguments which they have no business getting involved with. Another example, they decide that wearing a cross isn't part of Christian belief. There was a case of a British Airways worker who wanted to wear a cross, was told by British Airways she couldn't, took it to court, and British Airways' stance was upheld. Yet, people in other beliefs find that, for instance, yes, you can wear a Muslim headscarf. Well, fair enough, I don't object to that. But why not a cross as well? Or a Sikh bangle? Or even boys who are Sikhs can carry daggers, kirpans, on them. They're required to. In some cases, they've been allowed to take them into school. One case in the Canadian Supreme Court said, yes, it's part of the Sikh belief. A boy must be allowed to. take quite a vicious weapon into school. This isn't just Christianity that's being interfered with here. The new United Kingdom Supreme Court, just across Parliament Square from Parliament, also interfered not very long ago in matters of Jewish belief. The issue was criteria for admission to a Jewish school, and the argument was between Reformed Jews and Orthodox Jews, and the Orthodox Jews said, well, this boy hadn't, whose mother had been received into the Jewish faith, wasn't a Jew because being a Jew comes through matrilineal descent and she hadn't been received properly according to Orthodox procedures. Now this was in a sense an internal Jewish dispute. But the United Kingdom Supreme Court made it a matter of race and said it's racial discrimination here. And they said the school had to admit the boy. Now this went against Orthodox Jewish views about who counts as a Jew that goes back right to the Old Testament. In fact, the judgment started with quoting Deuteronomy. I think when a case in a Supreme Court starts by quoting Deuteronomy, one wonders what's going on, but still. They were certainly involved, I think, in theological argument of which you could say is really no business of theirs at all. In the Republic of Ireland, legislation was brought in just a few months ago to allow civil partnerships between same-sex couples. It even, in fact, threatens criminal proceedings against registrars who refuse. Now, that's one step worse than Britain, which just has sacked the registrars. In Ireland, there's the threat of criminal action because a public servant is refusing to implement the law. No attempt at all to respect conscience. That actually is, I think, of enormous interest, shows where a country can get, because in a sense the Republic of Ireland's background isn't dissimilar to Malta's. It was, for many years, a very strong Catholic country. I mean, if one was being a bit cynical, one would say that the alliance between Irish nationalism and Catholicism was a bit too close to be healthy. But still, there was a close relationship there. But in recent years, that seems to have totally fractured. And it isn't just divorce, it isn't just abortion, it's now civil partnerships that are allowed. And Ireland is going down the secular route in a very, very speedy way. Let me just quote one or two things that current government ministers in Dublin have said. I say current, I'm sure they won't be after Friday when there's an election, but still. The Minister for Justice said, what would the consequences be if we were to allow officials to choose the parts of the jobs they wouldn't do on the basis of their religious beliefs? That's about registrars not, in fact, registering civil partnerships. In other words, the state decides what shall be done. If you don't like it, then you're going to face criminal proceedings. No respect for conscience at all. And this in a state that has swung from almost an excessively Catholic stance, so that Protestants were uncomfortable living in the Republic of Ireland, to an excessively secular stance, so that when I went to lecture there a few months ago to a lecture organized by Catholics, the chair was taken by a Protestant Anglican bishop from the Church of Ireland, and there were plenty of Protestants as aggrieved as Catholics as what's going on there. The Irish Minister for Environment, similarly, dismissed those with conscientious objections to civil partnerships. He said they've got old and discredited prejudices. Well, that's a very sweeping statement to people with deep religious convictions. It got worse because he warned the Bishop of the Catholic Church not to intrude on temporal or state affairs. Now, remember, this isn't just a secular country. This is Catholic Ireland. And he said that bishops should mind their own business, and their business is conducting the Mass and not much else. Now, you can see the politics behind this. I mean, part of it is, of course, the background of scandals to do with child abuse in Ireland. But the whole swing of emphasis is away from upholding Christianity and the Church to really reviewing it as the enemy and not wanting to accommodate it at all. So this is all part of the chill wind of secularism that's blowing through the continent. Another example, European law typically says, and this I suppose is applied to some of the instances I've given, that if you want to do a job, you've got to do it according to the terms of employment of the set by the employer, and you've got perfect freedom, because if you don't like it, you can give up the job. So if your employer asks you to do something that's against your conscience, of course you've got freedom of conscience, because you give up the job. Now, this applies to Sunday working, for instance, and of course, even to situations where the job changes, where a man worked for 20 years in a job that didn't require Sunday working, suddenly it did, he was required to do it, he said, I don't want to do that, he had to give up his job. Now, I don't think the freedom to be unemployed is much of a freedom, but this is what European law is saying. And you can see the attitude here to religion. Religion, and of course it's Christianity that's the victim time and time again, I think the subtext sometimes is that people want to attack some forms of Islam, but then do so because they don't want to appear racist, and therefore attack all religion. That's an element in it. But at any rate, it's very often just old-fashioned prejudice against all religion. And religion is too often seen as a threat to be controlled, something we should be guarded from, freedom from religion. It's not seen as something to be nourished. State neutrality is upheld as an ideal, hence the idea of the separation of church and state. Now, neutrality is a complicated idea, but suffice it to say here, I don't think anyone or any institution can ever be totally neutral. You can't exist in a vacuum, particularly if you've got to decide to do one thing rather than another, or support one course of action and say another is not to be supported. You have to have some principles. Nobody can do anything without some principles, and unless they're totally arbitrary in what they do, but if you want to be consistent, you've got to act according to some beliefs about what's worthwhile and what isn't. So neutrality is an illusion. The state's neutrality is an illusion. Being neutral between different religious positions is all very well, but in the end, the state is going to take up a position of one kind or another. Now, I do think that the law must be impartial. The law has no favorites. But that's different from the state deciding what laws it should adopt, what ends it should pursue, what is worthwhile, what is good, what is bad, what is to be avoided. In the end, any state has to, even if it wants to uphold human rights, it has to think, why do humans matter? Because after all, when we talk about human rights, it's implicit in that, that humans are important. Some of you may remember there was a famous French philosopher, Derrida, well known for deconstruction. And he didn't believe, really, in anything to do with humanity, because he didn't believe in essences. I mean, there isn't such a thing as being human. But at the same time, he wanted to champion human rights, and I asked him once in a meeting how he could do that, how you can uphold human rights while not upholding the idea of being human. And his answer was, well, that was a complicated issue and he didn't have time to answer it, and I wasn't surprised. That actually being human raises the question, why are humans important? Pursuing equality is all very well, but why are humans equal? Why indeed is freedom important? In democracies, we believe it is. Even the slogan of the French Revolution about liberté, égalité, fraternité, freedom, equality, brotherhood, all make sense against a Christian background. Why are we free? Because God gave us free will. Why are we equal? Because God loves us all equally. We're all equal in the sight of God. Why are we brothers and sisters? Well, the very question begs for an answer because we all have the same father, so there's obviously a theistic background to that. So even that apparently rather atheistic slogan of the French Revolution came from the Christian foundations of Europe. And I think that any emphasis on human rights, which I do think are important, needs an emphasis on why humans matter, why it's important that we're equal, and why we are all free. So without a Christian basis, I think that in fact it's going to be very difficult to actually justify even some of the things that secular Europe holds dear. The neutrality of religion all too often slides into indifference and then positive hostility, which one can feel in many parts of Europe now. Once religion is made a private and personal matter, a matter of faith, not reason, religion is rendered powerless to influence or contribute to public discussion. Now, I haven't got time to go into the whole issue of faith and reason. It's a venerable philosophical debate. But just notice that reason is something we can all share. Faith, if it's cut off from reason, becomes something personal and subjective, idiosyncratic. I believe that faith is rational. Faith is in something. We can point to it and discuss it. Again, I think that the present Pope has often said something very similar. Faith is rational. Faith needs reason. So we shouldn't be afraid of reason in the public sphere. Indeed, there are bad elements in some religions, bad religions. So public scrutiny isn't something that's necessarily bad. If you say all religion is private, it's to be put in the private sphere. All that matters then is that everybody believes what's true for them. It can never be challenged, and that's unhealthy. I think myself that Christianity certainly needn't fear public debate or doubt its ability to contribute to it. Now, many fear a so-called theocracy. I'm never quite sure what that means, but I suppose they look at Iran in its present form and see religious rulers deciding what's right and imposing it in a totalitarian manner on everybody. And I think it is very tempting, and you can see through the history of Christianity, people have been tempted by this, that if you know what's right or think you know, it's very tempting to impose it on other people for their own good. But we're all fallible, and if we really do believe that God gave us free will, we have to recognize that other people have as much right as we do to make up their own minds. So in a democracy, I think we have sometimes to respect other people's views in the way that we hope they would respect ours. I've been complaining so far that in so much of secular Europe, the Christian conscience isn't being respected. In fact, what you're getting is almost the reverse of a theocracy. In distrusting religious influence, Europe, through its laws and collective institutions, is itself turning away from religion and even challenging freedom of religion and not seeing it as one of the most basic of human rights. Government's neutrality often involves distancing the country, the state, the law from religion, so that many European states are cut off from their Christian heritage. I think I was one of those that regretted, I thought it was just a symptom of what's going on, the fact that the Treaty of Lisbon, in fact, doesn't make any specific emphasis on the Christian heritage of Europe. You remember the last Pope wanted that in. I suppose the very fact that the Pope wanted something meant that for many people in Europe they were determined it wasn't going to be in. The Treaty of Lisbon's preamble merely refers to the cultural, religious, and humanist inheritance of Europe, which is very vague and can mean anything. In practice, we're being cut off then from our history, and we're also being deprived of the rational underpinning for our beliefs and rights. In fact, even atheists are beginning to see that there are dangers in this. Habermas was mentioned in the introduction, and he, I think, understands that the traditions, the religious traditions of Europe, are important in having formed us as we are, and we forget them at our peril. Even Richard Dawkins, a rip-roaring atheist, of course, in Britain, has worried about the vacuum being left with the withdrawal of Christianity. He said, well, he's a cultural Christian. Now, the problem is, of course, you can't have the good things from Christianity without Christianity. So there's a danger and a paradox there. But certainly what's happening in Europe is we're gradually being cut off from our roots. Legislators are being encouraged particularly, and again, Habermas I've heard mentioned this in a lecture, he said that legislators should leave their religious beliefs on one side as they enter the legislative chamber. Thus they're expected to deliberate about what's most important in human life without their judgments about what is most important in human life. And significantly, atheists aren't expected to do the same, so in that cliché there isn't a level playing field there. It's as if religion isn't rational. It's as if it's socially harmful, even anti-democratic. And I think that's what many people in Europe do believe. Now, of course it's going to be more persuasive if legislators can draw on reasons that don't just appeal to people who already believe in Christianity. To say the Bible says that, this is the teaching of the church, is all very well, but it's not going to convince people who respect neither. But appeals to human flourishing, to the common good, may very often reach people who would otherwise be repelled by what's being said. And if we actually believe that our religion, the traditions of Christianity, have shown what is good and bad for human beings, and surely that is what religion is about. I don't believe God wants what's harmful for us. If we think that the traditional teaching that we've recognized is about what's in our interests, other people can see it's in our interests, in their interests as well, even if they don't have the background beliefs. I was interested in looking at the Malta press over the last few days to see how, in the argument about divorce, there are different tendencies at work. One letter yesterday in the Times said, every Christian worthy of his faith has to just imagine Jesus Christ himself in front of him and put one simple question, do you want divorce? We all know the answer. I was impressed by Adrian Vesalio's argument, I'll vote for divorce when Jesus tells me to do so. Well, fair enough as far as it goes, but that's telling you that perhaps divorce is wrong. The question is whether, in fact, it tells you what the law should be, and I think legislators have also, obviously, to take into account a lot more. Something on the other side from last Sunday. As the people's representatives, MPs should be expected to act as impartial judges of the case for the minority, indiscriminately, fairly, and reasonably. They shouldn't turn their personal beliefs into crusades. That their private conscience should have nothing to do with their deliberations of the common good. Now, I'm a bit uneasy about both wings of that debate, actually. The one that just says, well, this is what Christianity says, so therefore, let's do it. And the other that says, private conscience has nothing to do with deliberations of the common good. How do we recognize what the common good is, unless it's through our conscience? Now, when I say that I'm uneasy about the first one, it's purely that you have to take into account more than what I think. I'm very much mindful of the situation, for instance, in America under Prohibition. I could imagine being a teetotaler in America at that time, absolutely convinced that alcohol was socially harmful, and therefore it would be very good to make it illegal. And yet one could see that the actual fact of making it illegal created a whole host of further problems. that it created criminality on a big scale, for instance. So that's the kind of thing legislators have to think of. They have to think more than just what do I think important for me, how would I live, what life do I want to live, but they have to think about the common good. But their own conscience about what's worthwhile and what's good and what's worth pursuing also informs that. Where that leaves the present debate, I don't know. But I think that it's crucial to see that this is a complex issue, that the government, the state, should not be neutral. But we should all come together to try and come to a common mind about the common good. And that's far from easy and far from a simple matter. Why is all this important? Well, of course, if you believe that Christianity is true, it's going to be important. But I also, just in ending, would like to stress that religion, or at least the characteristic impulses which go to make it up, is deeply grounded in human nature. I've been involved in the last few years in a project in Oxford to do with what's called the cognitive science of religion. Now, that's something that it researches the empirical basis of religion in human nature. And psychologists and anthropologists do recognize that, in fact, religion is something that's so deeply rooted as a primary impulse in human nature. It's universal, it's going to be in all societies at all times. It's why I think the secularization thesis is wrong. I mean, it was always going to be shown to be wrong. You can see that in the fact that people naturally believe there's going to be a life after death, mind is apart from body, that there could be non-material agency. I mean, if something goes bump in the night or leaves rustle in the forest, you'll think there's somebody there, and even if you don't see somebody or something, you might think, well, there must be somebody, even if I can't see it. And so the impulses that go to look for spirits or that ground religion are part of our natural makeup. Even ideas of omniscience are there from an early age. Little children find it very easy to think that their mother knows everything, and then by the time they're four, they realize that if she hasn't seen something happen, she may not know it has happened. But they'll go on thinking that God will know. My little grandson had a little experiment, and he said, well, God would know. And I said, well, why? Well, he said, God is God. And my granddaughter, the twins, said, well, God sees everything. Now, that's a natural reaction. Atheism is a second-order thing. It's like theology. It's reflecting on these reactions. I think even the most virulent atheist would find sometimes they naturally react in a way that tends towards religion. Now, all this just shows that religion is part of human makeup. It's not something private, personal, of no account. It's there as part of the building blocks of what it is to be human. So the very recognition of religion as being an important part of personal human life and inevitably of society, the very recognition of the importance of freedom of religion as an basic human right, exercising a part of human nature that's as important to us as the urge to drink or to sleep or to eat, that is all important. Religion is not a minor matter. It's not a private, personal matter of no little account. It's there, central. And I think modern Europe is making a great mistake in not taking that fully into account. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Trigg. Now, Professor Trigg will be having 20 minutes of questioning, more or less.
Well, I've clearly succeeded in shutting everyone up.
Just on the verge of saying so.
In some parts of Europe, what I would have said would have been highly controversial, and people would have been more or less storming the platform by now. I've emphasized the importance of Europe, I think, because, of course, Malta is very much part of Europe and the European Union, and these winds of change will be reaching the shores of Malta, undoubtedly. The pressures from Europe, from Western Europe, are mounting. And if you find that in a place like the Republic of Ireland they're having an influence, I think you'll find that undoubtedly they will influence the polity of a place like Malta. You will find that this kind of thing, it spreads, and although it's untypical of the rest of the world, this is a thing that I find so remarkable, that we'll find that, yes, Europe, large parts of Europe are secular and hostile to religion, and yet this isn't the way things are going elsewhere. So it's a curious thing, and it makes one think that probably what's happening in Europe is a local thing to do with, I suppose, partly the aftermath of the terrible events of the war and of the Iron Curtain, etc. It's the historical experience of Europe in the 20th century that's explaining this, it must be. Because if what I was ending up by saying is right, the tendencies to religion are very deep-rooted in human beings. Human beings are naturally religious, I would want to say. And I say that very deliberately. Now, which religion they have will depend on where they are and so on. But that they have an openness to religion, an openness to thinking about God, is undoubtedly true, or gods. I mean, it's unformed. It's more a readiness to think in terms of the transcendent. Now, we find that in a lot of atheist work, the assumption is that atheism is the default option, is the starting point, not religion. And that, I think, is wrong. Yes?
How do you explain that the prejudice against religion is mostly directed against Christianity, and that Western Europe seems to be more sympathetic towards other Eastern religions, other religions, Scientism, other forms of spirituality, but the bias seems to be more directed towards Christianity in particular?
Yes, I think that's an interesting point. I mean, in a way, it carries on from what I was just saying, that there are religious impulses in people, and they're going to show some way or another, even if it's just dabbling in astrology or witchcraft or something, or New Age. I mean, one typical, I think, feature of a lot of Western Europe is that there's a pick-and-mix attitude to religion, that we like a bit of this, and a bit of that, and a bit of Buddhism, and a bit of ritual, and in a sense, you pick what bits you like with religion. And I think one of the issues here is that the emphasis is very much on the individual. It's the individual and what the individual wants. And perhaps the emphasis on the individual has gone too far. One thing I didn't mention but could have is that it's not just individual freedom that's under attack, it's the freedom of institutions too. And I think that that's something that's particularly ominous. There was a case in front of the European Court of Human Rights last September where a German Catholic Church wanted to sack its organist because he'd left his wife, was living with her mistress, had fathered a child, etc. And they felt he was setting a bad example, and as someone prominently involved in the conduct of worship, they felt that he shouldn't be allowed to continue. And the European Court upheld him, not the church, and said that the church was invading his privacy and his right to a private life. So the right of the church as an institution, even to run itself, was being challenged. And I think that's all part of the stress on the individual. Yes?
Yes. I'd like to pick up this point about the contrast of Europe and the rest of the world.
Yes.
Would you not say that secularism in Europe is growing also as a result of affluence? There is also a great trend, although there are different tendencies in the United States where affluence is very strong, towards secularism as well, and possibly with the growth of the economies in other parts of the world, that secularism may be something which will grow there as well as a natural occurrence. Or do you disagree with that?
It's possible. I think what makes me hesitate, you mentioned the United States, but actually, I mean, all of the evidence shows, and I know the United States quite well, but it does suggest that religion, judged however you judge it, really, particularly through church going and belonging to institutions, is very strong and as strong as it's ever been. I mean, one interesting thing is, why is Canada so different from the United States? Now, maybe something to do with the existence of a welfare state, I think that's part of it. But certainly, I mean, you've got a very, very affluent America where, in fact, religion, if anything, is on the up and up. You go to very plush, say, suburbs in Northern Virginia outside Washington, the churches are full and flourishing. So I think that that isn't a general issue. I mean, obviously, you can even see it in the Bible, when people get affluent and get comfortable, they forget God. I mean, that's an old story. So there must be something in it, but it's not the only thing. And it isn't inevitable, I don't think.
That a Christian would have problems about participating in abortion, I mean, without doubt, it would go against his conscience. But it's not so clear to me why a registrar should find it against his conscience to register a civil partnership. Or it could be a judge to decide a divorce case, for instance. Would you think that that is a violation of somebody's, of a Christian's conscience?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. I mean, I've been a lay magistrate in Britain, and I've sometimes administered the law in a way that I wished I didn't have to. I mean, I would do things that I personally would disapprove of, but that was the law of the land, and my job was to administer it impartially. So in a way, I sympathize with what you're saying, but I do think that there comes a point where conscientious objection can be a reality. And the trouble is, the civil registrar case, it was a woman, actually a black woman. I mean, she could have said they were being racist, but she didn't take that line. But she said it was because of her Christian conscience, and she no doubt came from a black church and had very strong views. I don't think anyone doubted that she conscientiously believed it was wrong. Now, I think the question is not, is she right? Do we agree with her? But should we respect her conscience? I mean, the issue about religious freedom always becomes particularly, I think, difficult when you're talking about allowing people to do things you disapprove of and letting people do things that you don't think really are sensible, or you think she's making a fuss about something. The analogy, of course, is conscientious objection in time of war. Now, there have been plenty of times in history where conscientious objectors have been despised, or it hasn't been allowed. Now, for instance, in Britain and in the last war, conscientious objection was upheld. Conscientious objectors were even respected, even if people disagreed with them, and in some sense, perhaps were unhappy about it. But they thought that their conscience ought to be respected, that if somebody felt it was wrong to kill, they shouldn't be made to kill. Now, the question is the civil registrar in that position? I think the case is particularly more difficult when the law suddenly changed and she'd been for years in a job doing one thing, and then she was being required to do something else that she didn't want to do. Now, in that case, it was the London Borough of Islington, there were plenty of other registrars who could have taken civil partnership ceremonies. The issue wasn't, are these ceremonies to be allowed? The issue is, do we respect her conscience? There's no reason at all why they couldn't have said, look, you take that marriage, we'll do this civil partnership thing if you don't like doing it. But the London Borough of Islington wants to make a big thing about discrimination against homosexuality. So it wanted to say that discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation was of such immense importance, everything else must be swept aside, so they wouldn't respect her conscience. So I think that given that it was a religious conscience, you could see where she was coming from, I think that I would have wanted that. They could have accommodated her without any problem. They wanted to make an issue of it. And if they wanted to make an issue of it, I think a lot of people felt, hey, wait a minute, doesn't religion and religious belief matter too? So that's the issue. So, but as I said, it isn't would we have done the same, but given that's how she feels, how far should she be respected? And, I mean, in a way, you see, the sillier you think she's being, even if, as long as you think she's sincere and you can see it is grounded in her religion, the more agonizing the question becomes, I think. Yes?
With so many opposing views, how can the common good be agreed on?
Yes, well, of course, that is a good question. I think one can, emphasize too much the diversity of religions. I mean, most of them are very much minority religions. And also, I think one can emphasize too much the disagreement between. Very often, I find that the arguments aren't between different religions, it's between people of different religion and the secular juggernaut that's rolling. So, in fact, you'll find, and it's for that very reason, it's the most peculiar thing, but in Britain, some of the greatest proponents and supporters of the establishment of the Church of England are people in other religions. The chief rabbi, speaking about the establishment, is far more supportive of it than the average Anglican bishop would be. And they see the Anglican establishment as an umbrella protecting them, because it's allowing religion, all religions, to be seen in public life. If the church was disestablished, what that would be to say, we don't want religion in public life, and that would be the reason it would be disestablished. We don't want a religious voice. There is a national secular society in Britain. It actually has a small membership, but it has a big voice. And it went to the Council of Europe, and it was objecting very strongly to the fact that there are 26 bishops in the House of Lords. There are about 700 members of the House of Lords, so the 26 bishops can't do a lot. But still, the fact that there were official voices of the Church of England there, they objected to, and they said it's outrageous that representatives of a small, undemocratic body should be trying to influence public policy in this way. And yet there were these representatives of the National Secular Society trying to influence the policy of the Council of Europe and the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. As far as I could see, there wasn't very much difference. They were having a voice in public, and good luck to them. What's wrong with bishops also having a voice? No, they didn't want them to have a voice at all. They could have atheists in the House of Lords, but not bishops. And people in other religions can see this. So I think the dividing line is so often between the religious and the non-religious, the religious and the secular, not just the Muslim and the Christian, or the Muslim and the Sikh, or whatever. Yes?
Earlier on, you referred to the British distaste for the European Court of Human Rights and some of the adjustment. And I'm very glad that you pointed that out, because I think that's an important point and one which we should really start thinking about. I was listening to an interview with one of the senior officers of the European Court, and it came very clear from what the others were saying was that the vetting of the judges for appointment to these courts was in many cases, in many countries, almost non-existent, or rather existing in a communist way. And therefore, this is a matter of concern for us when their judgments affect our consciences. And I'm very glad that you pointed that out, and as a warning that we should keep watch on these judgments. Thank you.
Yes, well, there's a lot of feeling in Britain at the moment, and people are beginning to question, and I'm not in a position to say whether it's right or not, but they're beginning to question the academic caliber and legal knowledge of some of the people who are appointed there. And apart from anything else, there is the question of principle about how far a court can overrule a democratically elected parliament. Of course, it's structurally, it's not dissimilar to the question you have in the United States, where the Supreme Court can actually strike out legislation from Congress. Now, that's part of the US Constitution. but it still causes problems in the United States, and a lot of people in the United States are very distrustful of what they term judicial activism and say it's fundamentally undemocratic if it results in judges ruling on something which is against the will of the vast majority of the people as shown in their parliament or Congress. And that's the problem. In fact, it's a very good way, if you're a small minority, of getting your way if you can't get parliament to agree. It's going via the law courts, and you could find that 5% can get their way over the 95%. And that's happened in the United States. And it is a general structural problem. And the difficulty is if the European court gets more activist, and it seems to be, I mean, if it's widening its, the scope of its interpretations, then it's treading a dangerous path. It used to make a lot of what was called the margin of appreciation. In other words, it would let individual countries make their own decisions in particular areas within certain broad parameters. But if they narrow those margins too much and begin to set standards too narrowly, then you're beginning to set up a problem where, in fact, at the moment, you've got the beginnings of quite a big row between, interestingly enough, not just the British Parliament and the European Court, but also the British Supreme Court and the European Court, because the British Supreme Court don't like being overruled either. So, and this can spread to other countries as well. So there is a problem there. At the same time, obviously, human rights is a good thing. The European Court of Human Rights was set up in the aftermath of the war with the best of intentions. For many years, it seemed to function very well. But there are dangers there, I think. One of my favorite verses in the New Testament is, to quote the authorized version, "Now I see through a glass darkly, then face to face." And that picks up what you said then, in the sense that St. Paul was saying you see the distorted reflections in an ancient Roman mirror, and you don't see very, very well. But one day we will see God face to face, and we will know. And that, of course, is the hope that the Christian has, that however difficult things are here and now, and however clouded things are, we are talking about something objectively true, something real, something true for everybody, that will one day, perhaps not in this life, be vindicated. And I think one important thing about Christianity that I've always wanted to emphasize is that it is making claims about what is true, true for everybody, and therefore it's making claims that are universal, yes, and objective. They're there independently of my thoughts. So it isn't my faith, it's my faith in something beyond me, in the transcendent. And so it's something that will one day be revealed wholly, now perhaps only in part.
What do you expect them to do? What do you expect a Catholic politician to do in a scenario like this? Say the referendum, people vote in favor of divorce. Do you expect the politicians to accept the will of the people because there's a majority in favor, or decide according to their conscience, even if that might mean ignoring the will of the people?
In a sense, I feel this is a political question, because if you set up a referendum, you really have to face the fact it may not come out as you want. So, I mean, either Parliament decides or they have a referendum, and I suppose, even if it's a consultative referendum, you'd rather let something out of your control. You let the will of the people be a factor. If it was very, very close, or there was a very low turnout, then, of course, Parliament can use its judgment again. If there was a very big majority and Parliament says, we know better, my feeling as an outsider is, well, why did you have the referendum then? But, I mean, as I say, that's just the politics. I mean, we're having a referendum in Britain in May on changing the voting system. That was a pure result of a political fudge, because the Liberal Democrats wanted it, the Conservatives didn't. It was a condition of the coalition. And you've got the situation there where the Conservatives are going to be actually campaigning against the issue that they're setting a referendum on. But I think it's generally recognised that the referendum will decide there. I mean, you can't just have a They're not going to say, well, we don't believe in it, so whatever people say, we're not going to take any notice. That is difficult. But it all comes back to the conscience of the legislator. And it's a little bit like the civil registrar case, isn't it? Because there is a slight question as to when you're a public official, and I mentioned that I was once a lay magistrate, you have a public role which sometimes, if you're conducting that role conscientiously, may be prized apart from what you yourself personally think is right or wrong. Now, that there obviously are things so important that you would say, I'd never do that. I mean, I absolutely refuse to do that. I'd face death rather than doing that. But in the nitty-gritty of ordinary political life, perhaps compromise and adjustment are part of political life. The question is just, at what point should one say, this is a sticking point, I will not allow it? And obviously divorce, I'm afraid arguments about divorce have long since passed in Britain. In the 1960s, new divorce legislation came in, and I think it's been far, far too lax. And I've been very unhappy about the results of that. But still, that's putting it on one side. But similar issues arise over gay marriage. And certainly I can sympathize with people who will say that's so against everything they believe. It goes so much against the foundations of society, they will not allow it. Because once you allow that marriage is other than just between one man and one woman, then, well, the next stage wouldn't be just gay marriage, it could be polygamy. Where do you stop? So I can understand people feeling very strongly about it. I can't really, beyond sympathizing, I can't give a final answer to your question. I wouldn't like to be in that position. I mean, I hope that they don't get in that position.
Thank you very much, Professor Drigg. I think you will agree with me that Professor Drigg has enlightened us on many areas on a very important issue, which involves issues of conscience on several aspects of life, and which are not very easy to decide on. I'd like to thank you, Professor Drigg. I'd like to thank His Excellency for being present with us, His Excellency, and also His Excellency, the German Ambassador, and all of you for being with us here. Thank you very much. Good night.
You have just listened to a talk entitled Free to Believe, a Religious Conscience in a Secular Society. This talk was delivered by Professor Roger Trigg.